Hello everyone and welcome back to the Computer Vision in Production podcast show. The podcast show where we talk all about everything computer vision, from the individual components of the technology including vision, cameras and deep learning, right through to hearing about some of the most interesting applications that companies are using at the moment. Hello everyone and welcome to the Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest is Julian Schweitzer. Julian is the team lead for computer vision and machine learning at Necht. Necht are an emerging startup in Hamburg, Germany, who are focused around using computer vision for facial and security verification via a mobile phone. It's great to have Julian on the show. He's not only the team lead, but he's also, if I remember correctly, Julian, you're the first computer vision engineer, machine learning engineer they had, right?
Yeah, exactly. I joined back in August 2018, about a month and a half before we entered the market for the first time. There was an MVP, which was set up by our head of technology, but then I came in to kind of bring all of that a bit more up to speed.
Yeah, look, I suppose before we start jumping in and talk about what Necht are doing, look, why don't you give us a bit of an overview of your background, what got you into technology, what got you into computer vision?
All right, sure. I'm a physicist by education. I studied physics and then did a PhD in theoretical physics. I always wanted to build my own model of particle physics, which I actually got to do. However, at the end of that, I saw that academia is not for me. And going deep into myself, I realized that what I really like is building models of the world. So I figured data science might be a good direction to pursue that in a more industrial approach. And I joined a logistics company here in Hamburg, where I worked with large data sets, a lot of SQL, some Spark. But I realized that this large logistics company was just very slow moving to adapt to new technology. The impact I was having was just minimal for the effort I put in. So I looked for a smaller company to join. And actually, I was approached by the CEO, Benny of Necht, whether I wouldn't want to be their computer vision engineer. And that's how I ended up joining Necht. And nice. It's been quite a ride since.
Where did you meet Benny? Now, I know Hamburg is quite a nice, I suppose, inclusive tech hub in itself. You know, you have lots of partnerships between other companies who share information, do a lot of, I suppose, collaborated events around technologies. I know the guy from Pick-A-Like does quite a lot around that too, you know, in helping to upskill people into new domains. Was it through one of those methods, or was it through mutual connections, or?
It was actually, he just sent me a message on Xing, which is kind of a German LinkedIn kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, yeah. Didn't know Xing was big for computer vision.
it really isn't. But hit the perfect timing. I was in the train on my way back from a conference where I heard a lot about all the cool machine learning things you can do in computer vision that just wouldn't have an application for me in logistics. And then he was like, "Hey, how about we do some computer vision?" And I was really fired up.
Nice. That's good. So before you even got into computer vision, you were loving the idea of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I guess being a physicist, I really love working with complicated models and kind of getting an intuition for what's going on in these, let's say, mathematically involved scenarios is just something that I have a lot of training in.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a different type of data, right? I mean, the size of it, and you guys are even dealing with videos as well in some cases, the size of the data that you are actually working with is incredible. So it takes a lot of work. Let's go and talk about where Necht are now, and then if we kind of reverse it and then talk about how you started and what you've seen between them from you starting to them now. But I suppose let's build up to it. You know, let's talk about what there is now and then how you built up to it. So if you're down the pub and you're chatting to a friend who's a software engineer, maybe not big into computer vision, he says, hey, what a neck do. What do you say? How do you say it in quite simple terms?
All right. So we're trying to build a way for you to prove your identity online that's as user-friendly as possible, right? Because proving your identity online always is a barrier between where you are right now and what you actually want to do, right?
Yeah.
Nobody's doing it for fun. So what we want to achieve is a user identification that is quick, that is easy for the user to do, and that just is reliable for the companies that employ us. And for us, that means a lot, a really lot of automation, because the alternative is a video chat where you need to enter a queue, wait for a free agent, and then you have to chat with the agent, which takes 15 minutes or something, right? And then there's people that just don't want to talk to an agent, right? Say if you want to verify your, or if you need to verify your age for an adult website, maybe you're not comfortable talking to a call center agent about that, right?
Yeah.
And so we're building this app, plus of course the whole backend, for users to do all the steps that need to be done in order to properly verify your identity fully automatically. So you record two videos and sometimes a picture in the app, right? You record your ID card. Sometimes we need also a picture of the back. And then you record a selfie video. All of that gets uploaded to our service and processed automatically. And if everything goes well, the whole process can be done in 3 minutes, right? So it's a really low barrier, really good user experience is what we want to do. And of course, computer vision has a large part in making it quick and seamless.
Yeah. And now look, I know yous are doing that. And the reason why I say yous are doing that and doing it quite successfully is when yous go to the App Store, ratings can be brutal, right? You know, you look at some great apps out there like First Table, Open Table, who have like around a 4-star rating. Mm. I think I downloaded a taxi app the other day that had a 2.2 star rating. I was like, man, how can people have such bad experiences in taxis? But you guys have a very high star. You have like 4.7 out of like nearly 17,000 reviews, which, look, that's if I'm looking for somewhere to eat and I see that sort of level of reviews on Google, I want to eat there. So what is the product that's in the App Store and what's working so well with it?
I think it really boils down to us having this heavy, heavy focus on user experience. And this really is in the company's DNA. The original idea for the product occurred to our founder, Benny, because he was working as an app developer in an insurance company here in Hamburg. And he built this app with all these nice features for registered users. And then he saw that about 70% of the users that start the registration process actually never completed because it's such a hassle. So that's when he realized this must be a problem in the entire insurance industry and actually in all industries that want to do something digitally where you actually need to be sure that the person on the other end is who they claim to be. Right. So we started out with this heavy focus on user experience. And this really apparently strikes a chord with a lot of people out there, which we're of course super stoked about. Right. So our focus on user experience starts with the design of the app being very simple and easy to understand. We have explanation videos for all the steps that you can watch and that try to really pick you up where you are and tell you what you need to do. So ideally you only need to do it once. And then of course it's quick, right? And people just aren't used to digital processes in Germany being quick.
That's for sure. And then look, obviously one thing that is quite interesting to me is that, you know, it's caught on quite well. But what I want to know is where did this whole user experience come into computer vision and machine learning, or was it, what was your engagement like with the person who does user experience? Because I mean, look, at the end of it, you have to build something, you have to build an AI, one that people are going to have to believe in, not very easy to do. And then two, it's going to have to be, you know, easy.
So I think the biggest challenge in this whole user experience topic is, of course, that we also put a focus on being able to deal with less than ideal recordings, right? None of the actual, let's say, relevant processing for the result happens on the phone because, right, in a digital scenario, you can never trust the client. You can only trust your own server. But that means to us that we need to deal with videos where people didn't bother to turn on the light in the room when they record at night, right? So you get a lot of noise, a lot of salt and pepper noise, or because they only have a pretty weak light, the whole video is very yellow tinted, right? There's people that touch their camera sensors before recording, and then you get a mushy, blurry video. Right. And dealing with all these suboptimal situations and trying to recover from them is of course, something where we in the computer vision team can actively help with the user experience.
It's good that you have that because, you know, sometimes depending on the company, depending on the vision. So it obviously has to be something that's driven from the top down, that collaboration between user experience and, you know, AI, because I suppose, let's face it, everyone wants stuff that is easy, but they also want AI to add value. Sometimes adding value and being easy just don't go together, right? And you're giving yourself maybe an impossible task. It's clunky and it's never going to work. And then you push something out. It's got bad AI, but good user experience, or it's got good user experience and bad AI. But yous have kind of got a good philosophy of how that should look.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what really it comes down to is, of course, also that we understand the whole software development department to be more or less one team with different focuses. But we're all working on the same product, even though I wouldn't understand the app code and probably some of the app developers wouldn't understand our Python code, but we still have the feeling that we're working on the same product. And I don't know, when we put out a new feature, everyone tests it, right? I'm testing app features and the app guys test out new AI features we put in the backend. And that really creates an understanding across the entire tech stack.
So now let's take it in reverse. That's where you are now. That's the goal. Let's hear about the bad and the ugly. You talked it was MVP, when you were joining. What did the first couple of weeks and months look like? What was going on?
When I joined, of course, in the beginning, there were a few things that were kind of low-hanging fruit in order to get accustomed to the whole process. For example, in the MVP, we used an outside service for the voice recognition part of our app, right? So if you use our app, of course, at some point we need to make sure that the person we're seeing in the selfie video is actually live and it's a live recording, and we do that by prompting the user to speak two words, and the identification of which two words were spoken was kind of outsourced to a remote process, which is something we really don't like to do because we deal with very sensitive data, right? And we want to develop everything in-house. So this was one of the first things that I did, basically add this speech recognition component developed in-house specific to the data that we have. So now we're actually completely independent of any suppliers of cloud services or anything. And besides giving us more control over what actually happens, because we don't need to rely on some outside API, this is also a big boon because, of course, we're in a highly regulated sphere business-wise, right? And compliance can drive you nuts when signing contracts. And if you can just assure insurance companies, banks, and the like that there is not a single outside dependency, not a single American company involved in the processing of the data here in Europe. That just goes a long way to make things smooth in getting new customers.
So that was the fourth step. And that was to just do the real-time verification. Just to quickly check on that, do you do that real-time over the app, or are you doing that within microseconds, sending it back to the API, or what does that look like?
Actually, the process for us, the technical process always is that the app records media that get uploaded to the backend, and then the backend does the processing asynchronously, right? So we always work on a recorded video or a recorded image, which has the huge advantage that, of course, we can replay cases, right? We always have all the data we need in order to understand where the result of an identification process comes from.
Just to ask, I suppose, as a possible question, but when you introduced this use case, you know, the voice verification to make sure it's a real person, did you then, obviously, because that's good quality data that you can then use to actually then help to build out this platform and grow it. Is that something you've done, or how did you even go from data acquisition to here's voice verification real time?
We basically collect the data in production mostly. Right, so we get the consent of users to actually use some of the data they provide to improve our product. This of course helps a lot because this gives you just the real data, right? It's the real deal. Of course, when you enter in a new scenario, right? Say onboarding a new language, then in the beginning you need to work with a smaller data set. But fortunately, even a limited data set, if you frame your problem correctly, even a limited data set can get you all the way up to somewhere in the 80% success rate, which is good enough to start out. And then once you roll that out, you're very quickly going to acquire a lot more data, and you can very quickly improve on this kind of first model. So I think the trick really is to have a very good and precise problem statement, and to focus on the overall quality instead of the individual model, because there's a lot of recovery stuff, a lot of alternatives you might be able to use.
So then let's talk about the biometric face recognition then that was introduced from there. So unlike most of the competitors on the market, Neck differs because you use video verification instead of just 2D ID verification. We're all quite familiar with the 2D ID verification. Personally, for me, I've actually never used a video ID verification yet. I mean, probably the most advanced one I've had to use was Binance, where they've done something quite similar. Do you know, it actually sounds quite similar to what you guys are doing, but I think they made me hold like my ID and a picture of my face side by side in the one picture. So that's what they done, something similar to that. But I suppose looking at what you have, the 3D video verification, the 2D ID verification, what are the steps that you had to go for to build something like this? And again, I'm going to talk quite simplistic to getting data sets. Where did that all come from to result in this successful product?
All right. Yeah. So for biometric face recognition, there is quite a few data sets out there. Right. There is especially celebrity data sets are of course quite common. And we actually started out with a pretty run-of-the-mill kind of face recognition model from out there. But what's kind of special for us is of course, as you mentioned, we have videos, right? We don't have a single shot of your face. We don't only have a single shot of your portrait on the ID card. But we have a 7-second video at 30 frames that gives us 210 pictures of your selfie, right? And what's really interesting here is that of course across the video, if you compute the face embeddings, which you typically do for such a face recognition task, you do see quite some variation over the course of the video because of minute changes in the way you look at the camera, because of, I don't know, some lighting condition changes. Maybe you blink. Of course, you need to speak during the selfie video, as I mentioned earlier. And what we found is that by combining various face embeddings from different frames of the video into basically some kind of combined or refined embedding, we can get a much better face recognition performance than if we just took, I don't know, the first frame or a random frame. Right. So working with videos, which we actually do in order to be able to provide the check that these things were recorded right now, also really helps us biometrically.
You also talked a lot about image to image matching. What does that look like for you guys?
Typically, when you do a face recognition task, you basically have a neural network to extract what's called face embeddings from a face, right? From a picture of a face, and then you do that for basically your reference, which would be your little portrait on your ID card or passport, and then of course also for the person who you're trying to verify that is on this ID card, and then you try to compute the distance. What exactly is this distance depends on the model you use. And what's kind of special for us is that this whole thing, of course, happens as part of a larger process. So, for example, in order to do this, we need to find where the face is in each frame, for example.
Yeah.
However, we also need the information where the face is in each frame for our lip reading component, right? We also try to identify whether the person in the video actually speaks the words, and they're not spoken from, I don't know, offside or something, or I don't know, somebody puts a different audio track under a video. So what we actually did is we set up a whole network of microservices, right? One microservice for detecting the faces, one microservice for taking the video and the detected faces to compute all the face embeddings we need. By splitting up these tasks, putting them in microservices, we were able to basically put a flow-based programming approach on top of that to basically reuse the face detections also for, say, the lip reading or on the ID card. We can use that in order to validate that that all the security features are consistent with where we expect them for a given document in relation to the face, and so on and so forth. And this is actually quite special. I think there's few other use cases out there that need that level of complexity in their processing pipeline.
I suppose there's obviously a couple of other things that come into creating a successful face recognition product. And I suppose just going to touch on one that obviously you guys focusing and being very much around security and verification, so you just have to do deep fake detection, mask detection, you know, basically anyone that's going to try and spoof your system. Like, what are you doing to protect yourselves against that?
Well, of course, we do something. I won't go into too much detail here because, attack is not knowing exactly what we do, of course, is part of the deal. One thing we've made really good experience with is never trusting a single approach for these things, right? So, for example, for deepfake detection, there is deep learning-based approaches that you can do in order to detect deepfakes, basically training your network to spot them. But there's also classical approaches that you can do in order to tackle other parts of the process, such as, right, good old video forensics. Because what happens when you do a deepfake is you render the fake face frame by frame, And then you need to cut and paste this rendered face into the original video. And this cutting and pasting, of course, also leaves marks that you can just detect with good old computer vision video forensics approaches. And a combination of that gives us good confidence that we're well settled for the established methods, but would also have a very, very decent chance of spotting anything that would be completely novel and completely unbeknownst to anyone out there.
So we've got a good understanding of what goes into, you know, a face recognition product now. But taking it from the road to research into production, I know we've spoke about that, but I suppose, what did you learn from this? I mean, of course, having a face recognition product from video and face and IDs, when you know all the data sets, when you know, hey, we've got 1,000 celebrities and celebrities' passports, and it's running, it's training off the same stuff. But now users are running this model onto someone's mobile phone. You know, what challenges did you come up against? What did you face?
I think one of the challenges is basically making sure that the whole pipeline stays scalable. Right, there is a lot of talk about ML ops these days, and I think this is a very important field, and I'm really glad to see that it becomes more professionalized and more of a focus in the past, I don't know, year or so. Because as soon as you start doing things that are out of the box, right? Say working with videos instead of pictures, or trying to work with crops from videos, even a lot of the standard tooling really quickly comes to its limits. Right. So one challenge for us is that that we always need to that we need to do a lot of custom building of our inference pipeline of our services. Simply because a lot of the tools that are readily usable don't fit our use case well enough. So that always has been a challenge. It still is. And I'm just really glad that this whole line of work is getting more interest also from I think from a more academic standpoint.
So did you kind of come across any sort of like production issues or any sort of challenges where you said, oh, look, maybe it's we use a TensorFlow instead of a PyTorch or a Keras, or, hey, let's go with GCP instead of AWS. Was there anything like that really came into your decision making process, productionizing the software?
Well, as I said, we had to custom build a lot of things. And while we are deploying in Kubernetes, we're actually running our Kubernetes cluster ourselves. It makes a lot of things easier in terms of compliance regulations, right? If we're not in the cloud, we don't need to, you know, file the 30 pages of cloud security report together with the contract. So I think the biggest learning has been that. A lot of the standard things just don't apply when you try to custom build an inference pipeline for machine learning, because we have large requests, we have long latencies, right? And when you look up best practices on deploying microservices on Kubernetes, you see sometimes tips for long latencies of 500 milliseconds. Well, I have a service in my pipeline that takes 10 seconds. To process a request, right? So all of the standard lore or all of the blog posts you find on the web just don't apply to our situation.
Gotcha, yeah. And then, so I suppose just on something that you mentioned to me that stood out as well as how you've done things a little bit differently, but you've also done inference pipelines with flow-based programming. When you've moved into, coming from research into production, you know, how did that impact what you're doing?
I think this was a really good pick for what we're doing, because I think I mentioned it earlier. The flow-based approach allows us to reuse intermediate results, right? So we don't need to go and recompute the same thing over and over again, just because we need to know where the face is in, I don't know, five different applications in our stack. But also, what it allows us to do is it allows us to modularize the whole setup, right? We have proper microservices. Each microservice has a specific, well-defined task, and can basically be deployed independently and replaced independently. If we do a complete rewrite of our face recognition, for example, we could basically do that as a drop-in replacement without changing anything else in the stack. And that is just extremely powerful, extremely useful, and allows us to keep this whole complicated system very maintainable.
You mentioned that, you know, you're excited to see how some of the topics that have been researched in around, you know, biometric face recognition are now actually coming into play and are in business, are in production, products are being built that are, you know, on the, I suppose, coming from the foundations of these heavy research topics. So let's take it from, you go from research into production, but you come from a strong researched background. I suppose, what's the main benefits or positives that you can see to a company for having that research background?
I think one of the key benefits is really having a deep understanding of how things work, which gives you so much more leeway in adapting it. If I'm somebody who just knows, let's say, the very, very practical aspects of it, maybe know how to fine-tune an image classification model, but never got to the down lows of how it works, why it works, and so on and so forth. And just very quickly confused by all the knobs and screws I can turn when actually adapting this for an application in practice. So having a more research-oriented mindset really helps in having a deep understanding of all the bits and pieces that go together and why they go together and why they are needed, or vice versa, why they are not needed, right? You don't always need a ResNet 50 backbone to do your task. Sometimes just putting down 10 layers that you train from scratch is enough, and much faster, of course, than using these complicated pre-trained models.
Nice. Look, that's really helpful. And then look, I'll finish off, Julian, with one final question. When it comes to computer vision, and let's say, you know, the breakthroughs we've seen over the last couple of months and years, what topics are you in particular most excited about, and what do you think can have the biggest impact to, I suppose, the world, or even if the world is too broad, maybe your industry?
One thing I'm very, very excited about is, I would say, the run that transformers have had lately. Convolutional neural networks have been around for quite a while now. I think we understand them very well. They have been well optimized, and for probably 95% to 99% of business applications, convolutional neural networks are just good enough. They're reliable. They're well understood. But I think transformers can offer just that bit extra that sometimes you need. And I'm excited to see that their performance, both in terms of compute and memory, has improved in the vision domain. And I'm really, really interested and excited of following where that leads and when it is, let's say, practical for us to actually dig into that technology to get that last few percent out of a specific use case.
That's perfect. And that will also take us up to time, Julian. So thank you for being such a fantastic guest. And for everyone listening, this is the Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest was Julian Schweitzer. Julian is the team lead for computer vision and machine learning at NECT. Thanks again, Julian. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Computer Vision in Production podcast with your host, Anthony Kelly. To make sure you get updates on the latest episodes of the show, make sure you subscribe on your preferred podcast listening app or add me on LinkedIn.